So today I'm going to talk about the many worlds interpretation. This is due to Everett from 1957. Okay. I'm trying to think how to do this. So the many worlds interpretation. Everett didn't call it the many worlds interpretation. I think he called it the relative state interpretation. The name many worlds was invented by someone else. I think DeWitt. I'm going to give you the axioms for the many worlds interpretation. Axiom one, the ontology at some time t is given by the wave function. Axiom two. The wave function, axiom two is that the wave function evolves according to the Schrödinger equation. And that's it. Okay. So the claim is that this is sufficient to do two things. One, recover the appearance of the world. So we have, definite, we have apparatuses, chairs, tables, things in definite places, definite states. So one, and two, to recover the empirical content of quantum theory, namely the probabilities that we can calculate. And you can see that might be problematic because we don't obviously see definite events in here. We have the measurement problem we've talked about. As we'll see, probabilities aren't obviously in this picture either. Okay. So that's the many worlds interpretation. That's the those are the axioms. We have the ontology is given by the wave function, and the wave function evolves according to Schrödinger's equation. Nothing else. There's a vast literature on the many worlds interpretation. I'm certainly not an expert on this. I'd say the best work on many worlds interpretation has been done by philosophers. And so the style of argumentation and discussion in this lecture is going to be a bit different from previous lectures because it will be following those kinds of philosophical, more philosophical tradition. And in particular, I'm going to follow the approach of David Wallace, who is a philosopher actually, he was in Oxford, now he's in the US somewhere, I forget where. And if you're interested in this and you want to hear it from David Wallace instead of me, which I advise, then you can watch two talks he gave here at Perimeter. So back in 2005, which is, I guess, quite a long time ago by now, there was a sort of course on interpretations of quantum theory. Various people came and gave talks. This is a course you can find at this collection. So that's five. So there's a course there, lots of interesting talks on different approaches to quantum theory. And David Wallace gave two talks in here. So there was 05, 01, 03, and 16. So those two talks. And roughly speaking, the first of his talks concerned solving the problem of accounting for the appearances of the world. Why, you know, why do we see definite objects and so on? And the second of his talks focused on the problem of probabilities. Okay. Okay, so the two problems. So the first problem is, where does the world structure come from? So in the many worlds approach, you imagine that you get this kind of splitting into different worlds where different things happen. You've all seen this, the science fiction movies based on this idea. And we also need to say in what basis. Remember when we discussed the measurement problem, there was this issue of deciding what the correct basis is to describe your measurement outcomes. And the approach that David Wallace takes here is strongly influenced by work by another Oxford philosopher, Simon Saunders. So, And then the second problem is, where does the Born rule, the Born rule in quantum theory is basically the rule that says that probabilities are given by amplitude squareds. So where does the Born rule come from? And Wallace's approach here is strongly influenced by ideas of David Deutsch. Just as a historical side note, so David Deutsch has been a very ardent advocate of the many worlds interpretation. And it was also David Deutsch who put quantum computing on a firm footing, after some early suggestions by other people. David Deutsch sort of wrote down, the universal quantum Turing model and all these different things that we now take for granted. David Deutsch was inspired to think about quantum computing, motivated to, because he believed in the many worlds interpretation. So he had this idea that all these computations were happening in parallel, and perhaps we could find a way to harness what was going on in these different many worlds. And so for him, the power of quantum computation comes from the many worlds aspect of the of quantum theory. I think it's a nice example of how thinking sort of about these interpretational matters can lead to progress in applications. Okay. So let's start with the first problem, which is where does the world structure come from? And the idea of Wallace, also following on from Saunders, is that fundamentally what you have is the wave function, and then this world structure is a kind of emergent property. So it's not there fundamentally, but it's something which is emergent. He gives an analog, talking about tigers. Okay, so imagine you want to study tigers. Well, one way to study tigers would be to look at each of the fundamental particles inside the tiger, the electrons and protons and neutrons and whatever level of description you want, and to try to work out, how those are moving, and ultimately build up to an understanding of how a tiger works from that very basic level. Of course, if you tried to study tigers in that way, you would get nowhere because it would be very difficult. Another approach might be to look at the cellular structure. So you look at the cells and how they're behaving, and you build up some understanding of tigers in that way. And that would be also very difficult, though you might make a bit more progress. And another approach would be to take a more sort of zoological approach, where you look at the behavior of tigers, look at their hunting patterns and their feeding patterns and this kind of thing. And so you study tigers from that sort of perspective, higher level, more macroscopic sort of things that they do. And so he's advocating that is a better approach in some sense. Well, it depends what you want to study, but that's an approach. And then taking that over to the problem of finding the world structure, he wants to argue that this world structure is something which emerges as a quasi-classical level. It isn't there fundamentally. It's a structure that you can see in some sense emerging at the quasi-classical level, in the same way that hunting behavior and feeding patterns emerge for tigers. If you're only interested in the behavior of fundamental particles, you don't really care about hunting patterns and feeding behavior and so on. And likewise, at the fundamental level, you just have the wave function evolving. But because we live in this world at a more quasi-classical level, you want to try to explain how we use the theory, so that has more to do with our behavior. It's sort of similar to hunting patterns. So that's the idea. So at the fundamental level, there isn't a splitting into different worlds. the splitting into different worlds is something which happens it emerges at a quasi-classical level. Okay. Okay, so this is important because there's other approaches to the many worlds approach where people say, you know, what happens is every time a quantum particle can go one way or another, then you have a splitting into worlds. You have one world where it goes this way and one world where it goes that way. So that's a different kind of approach. And the one of the problems with that approach is you're effectively adding another axiom. You're saying the splitting, there's an axiom saying when your splitting happens, okay. And there have been various types of attempts to say when the splitting happens. The beauty of this approach by Wallace and Saunders is that it's avoiding that question. However, it still has to account for this emergent quasi-classical structure that we have. So this is how it does it. It uses decoherence. To argue that at the macroscopic level we have this emergence of quasi-classical worlds. So let me try to show you how this works. Imagine we have an experiment like this. So we send a particle in to some measurement apparatus. Initially, the measurement apparatus is in a zero state. And then we send this particle, it comes at the other end, and we send it into a second measurement apparatus, also in the zero state. The particle comes out again. So in this on this apparatus, we measure some quantity A, and then here we measure some quantity B. So how does the evolution look? Well, we start off with a wave function in some initial state, and the apparatuses each in their zero states. And now let's evolve the apparatus through the first system. And I'm going to decompose this wave function into a superposition of the eigenstates of the operator that we're measuring here. And for simplicity, let's assume it just has two eigenstates. So this could be a spin half particle, for example. So that's the evolution that you would expect after going through the first piece of apparatus. Now we want to evolve it through the second apparatus. And what we can do is we can write down each of these eigenstates that are with respect to the A measurement. We can write them down as a superposition of eigenstates with respect to the second measurement. So let's just write down this one. I'll write it down as gamma B1 plus delta B2. And this one, I want it to be orthogonal to that. So I'll write it down as minus delta star B1 plus gamma star B2. So if I put that in and evolve it through the second apparatus, then, well, I'll just write down what I have. And there's probably a mistake in that somewhere. Yeah, let's see. I think this should be a 2. And these should both be 2s. Let's see. A1, B1, A1, B2, A2, B1, and A2, B2. Okay. That's probably correct. So now let's try to draw a picture which sort of captures what's going on here. So initially, what we have is we have both of the apparatuses are in the zero state. So I represent that by some sort of, you know, this is sort of the world structure coming in. They're both in the zero state. Now what happens is we have a splitting. Make sure I have enough room here. And this will be after the first measurement, so this is where the first measurement happens. And now we have in this world we have A1 B0, and here we have A2 B0. And then we have further splitting. After the second measurement. And now we have, okay, you have here A1, B1, because we've got outcome 1. Over here, well, we still have A1, B, outcome B2, and move this over here. And then over here we have, A2, B1, and here we have A2, B2. And if we had more measurements, if we had, you know, a measurement C and so on, then we'd keep having this splitting, this branching, as we evolve forward in time. Okay. Any questions? At this stage. Yeah, go ahead.
So you said that this book is basically going to demonstrate how Wallace uses decoherence to argue that we have the emergence of worlds.
Yeah, I haven't got to the decoherence part yet, but it is going. That is coming. Yes. Yeah. Good. Good. Well anticipated. Anything else? No. Okay. Okay. So. Yeah, so let's move on to that question, in fact. What is it that picks out the basis for this branching? So here I've chosen a basis for A, which was A1 and A2 separately. I could have instead have had something like a superposition. So I could have chosen that basis. Let's call those states. Those A plus and minus states are also orthogonal. Why shouldn't I have chosen those states instead? Well, to argue this, we want to invoke that there's also some environment. Okay, so we have some environmental degrees of freedom. And these can be, environmental degrees of freedom could be, well, they could be internal degrees of freedom of the apparatuses themselves. There's a lot of, in addition to merely telling you that you have one outcome or another, there's a lot of internal degrees of freedom inside the apparatus that do additional stuff in as well as telling you that. And also these environmental degrees of freedom can be stuff in the physical environment around the apparatuses, like the air or the light particles. So for example, if you have a pointer that goes to one position when you have A1 and to another position when you have A2, then light will scatter off the pointer if it's in position one in a different way from the way it will scatter off the pointer if it's in position two. And so now the state of the environment will have imprinted on it one of two states according to what state you're in. So if you take all those environmental degrees of freedom, let's just call them E0, in addition to the initial state of your, let's say the initial state of your apparatus, which is A0. Okay, and now we're going to say that evolves, well, let's say, first of all, that evolves to some measurement outcome. Okay, that goes in here, but now you have the different terms. You're also being hit by AI, okay, which is the system coming in. So that evolves to okay, this is what I showed in the calculation. Previously, I didn't put the environmental degrees of freedom in. And now you have another step where the environmental degrees of freedom get correlated with your apparatus. First step is the measurement. The second step is interaction with the environment. Okay. And this is going to happen very quickly, certainly on the time scale which, with respect to which we experience the world, this will be a very quick process. And these states of the environment will be roughly orthogonal afterwards. Okay. Now this equation I've written down is true with respect to a certain basis. And typically the kinds of interactions you have in nature are ones that are the Hamiltonians that drive those interactions are local with respect to position. So if you write down the Hamiltonian, the terms in that Hamiltonian are local with respect to position. And so so the kind of states which respect this are going to themselves be local with respect to position. So a pointer being, here's a pointer initially points up, afterwards it could point in this direction, for example, or this is the one direction. Or it could point in the two direction. If it's pointing in the one direction, that's a quasi-local state. And so this is the kind of thing that's going to obey this sort of interaction, given that your Hamiltonian has local interaction terms in it. You could instead consider a superposition of having a pointer here and having a pointer here. Okay, so that would be one of your A plus or minus states. But because the interaction Hamiltonian in this situation is quasi-local, it will very quickly entangle separately with these two different things. And so the interaction, if I was to put plus and minus in here, then it won't look like this. Okay. So because of the locality of the interaction, because of the locality of the interaction Hamiltonian, you end up picking out states that have this property, which are themselves local or quasi-local. Okay. Any questions on that? Yeah, go ahead.
How are you defining quasi-local? What if I had like a huge pointer that was like a kilometer long? Like, at what point is it?
A very long pointer would be fine because you know, the interaction Hamiltonian is local here, it's local here. So between the photons that are interacting with it here are local and so on all the way through. So the environment, if it's interacting with it, would be lots of local interactions. Whereas if you had a superposition, you'd have a superposition between some interaction here and some interaction over here, which is non-local, and likewise and so on. So it would get. It would get bad. Of course, if the pointer was a kilometer long, then there'd be even more. The decoherence would be even faster. Yep. Go ahead.
I don't think I understand the conclusion of the argument. So how does that show independence of the basis?
Oh, okay. So let me. So there's more to say. So at this stage, I'm just telling you. What is more or less a fact about kinds of Hamiltonians we have in nature, the local Hamiltonians. So this is just a fact. But now we want to apply this to this kind of picture. And the argument there is about persistence or stability. So you could try to write down a world branching structure where you had pluses and minuses on here, but it wouldn't be a persistent structure. It would very quickly decay here. So, you know, so immediately after this measurement, you might have plus and minus here, but very quickly that would get wrapped up with the environmental degrees of freedom, and you would no longer have that structure on the branches. So it's, the key thing is to take this argument over to this branching structure. The key thing is that this is a persistent structure. Your subsequent interaction with the environment, you'll continue to have this thing, this quasi-local state as it is. Whereas had it been a superposition like an A plus or an A minus, it would have disappeared. So the key thing is to connect with the branching structure is the persistence. Or the stability. So what is clear is that given this environmental decoherence argument, there's really only going to be one, there's only going to emerge one kind of branching structure. All the other ones will be very quickly squashed. And this is something that happens at a quasi-classical level. It's not there fundamentally in the state vector. It's something that emerges.
So what does it say about the reality of these branches? Are these branches all real?
Well, the wave function is real. Okay. The wave function, that's my first axiom, the wave function is real. So each of these branches are real because they're parts of the wave function. And furthermore, we have this branching structure that we can extract at a quasi-classical level. That's also something that is a feature. Similar to tiger hunting patterns, it's something that emerges. It's not there fundamentally, but it is emergent. So the branching structure is real at an emergent level. Any other questions? I can feel.
This appears to violate the conservation of energy because we have constantly branching worlds, and each of these worlds have like same energy somehow.
I mean, energy conservation in quantum theory is an interesting subject. There was a paper on the archive yesterday by Yakir Haranov and co-authors, and it's people are thinking about. You suddenly have a statistical conservation of energy, but then you can ask, is energy conserved in individual runs of the experiment? In many worlds of language, that would be individual branches, and that's not so clear. Ian?
What stops non-commuting measurements from occurring back at the same time?
When you describe an experiment like the one I've described, you have to sort of put in place the nuts and bolts of your particular measurement apparatus. Okay, so you have to say this is the measurement I'm doing. So you can only have one box in place. If you wanted to do a different measurement, you could have done a different measurement. So you certainly have to have one operational device in place. Now you might be asking about it is in fact possible to build what are called positive operator valued measures, which can be interpreted as measuring multiple non-commuting observers at once, so non-commuting observables at once. So there exist these things called POVMs. And for example, you can build a POVM that will approximately measure position and approximately measure momentum at the same time. So that's an interesting subject in operational quantum theory. However, it doesn't really change the conclusions because those POVMs can always be interpreted as a standard projection valued measure, which is the kind of measurement I'm talking about here, on the original system plus an ancilla. Okay, so. So these aren't really a problem for many worlds. They're just, I think, they're an interesting aspect of quantum theory, but but not ones that we have to bear on this problem. Any other questions? Yep.
Yeah, I'm still not sure I understand the stability argument and why the environmental degrees of freedom suppress the other branches.
You don't understand it, you said?
The stability argument. Why are A plus and A minus not stable?
So, certainly immediately after the measurement, I have this, immediately after the first measurement, I have those two terms, okay? And I didn't write in the environment. I should really go back and put in the environmental degrees of freedom. And I could have instead, immediately after the measurement, written them down with respect to plus and minus instead. Okay. And initially, immediately after the measurement, that would be fine. But now I bring in those environmental degrees of freedom. And it would look, it wouldn't have this property that it continues to just be those two terms in the plus minus spaces. You'd have, in fact, four terms, which would rearrange to being the same as the one with just two terms, but it wouldn't have that structure. So that those plus and minus states don't really survive, whereas the one and two states of the apparatus do survive. They're persistent.
Can we also express the environmental degrees of freedom in a different basis?
You could. It wouldn't make any difference because you could put these ones in a different basis, plus or minus basis. You could put these in some other basis. Well, let's say these ones. You could put these in some other basis. Let's call those plus minus. I don't know. Some other basis as well. The whole thing would just get more complicated. It wouldn't have this product state form. It would be entangled. The key thing is this is a product state, more or less. That's the key difference. Yeah.
What if we really isolated the system from the environment?
Okay. If you were able to really isolate the system from the environment, then maybe the many worlds sort of way of thinking would make different predictions. You know? If you could, if you had, especially if you got to the point where it was your brain that was making the observations, so you could have some sentient experience relating to this. Maybe, and you'd have to have a small brain in that case to be able to enjoy that. But maybe you could have some interesting things. There's a whole field of study in quantum foundations called sort of Wigner's friend arguments, and then there's extended Wigner's friend arguments, and which have been studied a lot recently, which leverage the idea that maybe you can recohere different brain states corresponding to different outcomes, and then you get all sorts of very strange things happening. If I have chance to prepare a lecture on that, I will. But you're good.
If you consider the universe as a whole, doesn't the environment vanish if the whole many worlds theory collapse into one universe?
So one thing that's happening here that Wallace is assuming is taking advantage of a sort of tensor product structure in the universe, that you can write down the wave function with respect to a tensor product into different subsystems. So the whole universe, you might say, is just described by some state which is in a big Hilbert space. Okay, but he's adding an extra structure here, which is that this Hilbert space is in fact a tensor product of lots of, how can I write this? It's a tensor product of lots of subsystems. Okay, and he's using that structure without questioning where that structure comes from. There is a project where you say let's not assume this. In fact, let's try to derive this structure. And then you'd say, well, I also have a Hamiltonian, which is an operator on these kinds of Hilbert spaces. And what you can do is you can try to derive this tensor product structure by assuming that the tensor product structure respects approximately respects locality in this Hamiltonian. So, you know, here we said the Hamiltonian has only local terms, and that's why these things are stable. But we could turn that around and say what we mean by tensor product structure is something which makes the Hamiltonian look local. Okay, so that's a research project which I originally heard about that idea from Michael Nielsen. People have been thinking about it a bit more in recent years. It's a difficult project. But, yeah, but this is a good point. Okay, any more? Yep, go ahead.
Does this decoherence argument stay even without the many-word interpretation?
Yeah. I mean, this is just a piece of mathematics using the certain properties of the Hamiltonian. So that remains, and you might try to say this is a way to solve the measurement problem, and it certainly solves part of the measurement problem. It solves the basis problem, but it doesn't solve the why do I observe or experience, at least, why do I experience definite outcomes, and many worlds approaches attempts to solve that problem by saying, well, you have this emergent branching structure, which ultimately includes ourselves as well. We get in this state. So that's the kind of argument.
Also, I don't know if this makes sense, but does the branching happens in two different branches, or there's a single branch going from the previous world and there's another branch getting it?
I would say I say these are on an equal footing, if that's what you mean.
Right.
Yeah, I'd say they're both pretty much on an equal footing. Yeah. Okay. What are we doing? Oh gosh. I thought I'd cover the second issue as well here. There's an interesting analogy you can think about, which kind of relates to this, is imagine you had a cloning machine, which you step into the cloning machine, and then it spits out two copies of you. Okay, this is kind of what's happening. You're going into the cloning machine, and then these two copies can't interact with each other anymore because of decoherence. So it feels like as if you really have these two copies which are separate. So this is exactly what's happening in the many worlds. You step in, you have one copy of yourself here, one copy of yourself here, and it's kind of that disturbing. Okay. So let me begin to talk about the problem of probability. So I think the general consensus in the community is that the first problem, the problem of this branching structure, is solved in the way I've described, but the second problem, which is the problem of probability, the jury is still out, I think. So problem two, probabilities in the many worlds interpretation. And the problem is that everything that has non-zero amplitude certainly happens. To give an example, let's just take the first part of that measurement I described before. And now let's imagine that beta is equal to 10 to the minus, well, I think every time I give this lecture, I increase the number of zeros. So now 10 to the minus 10,000. OK. So beta is incredibly small. The amplitude there is essentially zero. Certainly, in your everyday life, if there was something that had probability, probability is that squared, 10 to the power minus 2,000, if something that had the probability 10 to the minus 2,000, you wouldn't really worry about it. You wouldn't take it remotely seriously. However, in the many worlds interpretation, this thing still certainly happens. It absolutely definitely happens. So then, if it definitely happens, what do we mean by probability? Can we say, what is the point in saying this has a very small probability when this definitely happens? It makes no sense. Even if we did admit to the existence of probabilities, even if we said, no, we think there's this branching structure, so there are clearly probabilities, why would we say that the probability for this branch is very small and this one is very big when both branches are present? Maybe we should instead say that the probability for this branch is 1/2 and the probability of this branch is 1/2. Why wouldn't we choose that instead? The ontology is such that it definitely happens. You know, there's no sense in which this world is dimmer because it has a small amplitude. You know, colors are just as bright, feelings are just as intense. Everything in this world is just the same as this world. It's just as valid an experience. It happens to have a small amplitude associated with it. Okay, so that's the problem of probability in the many worlds approach. And if you want to pursue the many worlds approach, you kind of have to solve that problem. How can you say, well, that really we want to think of this as the probability? I won't have time to give you the discussion now. I'll do that next lecture. But David Wallace's approach uses the study of decision theory. So there's a field of called decision theory, which existed exists independently of the study of many worlds approach or quantum theory. And one of the textbooks is on this is by Savage, L. Savage. It's in the foundations of it's called the Foundations of Statistics. And in this approach, you have a set of decision theoretic axioms, and then you can you can find a representation theorem, and then you have the idea that rational agents have to ascribe probabilities to certain events in accord with this representation theorem. So what I'll do next time is and then David Wallace uses this theory, this decision theory concerning agents, in this context to try to solve the problem of probability in many worlds. It's a very interesting approach because you start off with no probabilities. You've just got those two axioms. There's no probabilities in there at all. Then you have this emergence of quasi-classical worlds. And then in that context, you think about what agents would do. You subject agents to a bunch of axioms. And then you have an argument that probabilities themselves also emerge, despite not being there in the fundamental theory. So it's a very interesting theory. It's an interesting approach. The jury, like I said, is still out on whether it works. But I think even if it doesn't work, it's extremely, extremely noble attempt in the foundations of quantum theory to solve a really difficult problem. Okay, so I'll talk about that next time. Any questions before I? Yeah, go ahead.
Why can you not say that the wave function breaks with duplicate states with given probabilities? So you have 10 to the power of 10,000 cases of A1 with amplitude which are thus reduced.
Yeah.
And one case with the other case.
Yeah, so David Wallace's approach does effectively leverage that kind of idea that you try to, he makes an argument, which I'll show you next time, that so branches that have equal amplitude should have equal probability. There's an argument for that. And then you can start to do these manipulations where you divide up the world into equal amplitude sized portions.
So you get multiple branches, right?
So you get multiple branches, yeah, exactly, yeah. You can try to do that. There's still a problem, which is, you know, why would I believe my probabilities are related? Why would I believe my probabilities are equal when my amplitudes are equal? So at least that's some progress. Okay. Yeah.